This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about the possibility of expanding hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, in Central California.
People are really concerned about a lot of things. The big picture about climate change, but also really the health of their community.
Also, if you're a Democratic presidential primary voter, how will you decide who gets your support? We chat with four undecided California Democrats.
I'm all about electability. I feel we have to get Trump out of office.
If you start thinking about political considerations before you've put together your policy proposal, you're doing this backwards.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It is Monday, June 10th, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. Let's begin today's show in Santa Barbara. We've previously reported that the city's landfill is filling up. Now, in an effort to help improve how the city handles recycling, fees for trash and recycling curbside services will go up next month. So, to help us dive back into the issue of trash in Santa Barbara, here's the host of sister station KCRW's podcast, The 805, Jonathan Bastian.
It's kind of nice how every couple of days your garbage just magically disappears, right? Well, as we all know, it's not quite that simple. All that garbage and recycling has to go somewhere. And if you live in the Santa Barbara region, it goes to the Tahiguas landfill, which is filling up fast. And this means higher prices for Santa Barbara curbside trash collection starting July 1st. Here to explain why the city is raising rates and where all that money is going is Brian Latchford, Outreach Coordinator at the Environmental Services Division for the city. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Notices have been served. I've seen them in my house, and it's going to get more expensive to get that trash out and recycling. Tell us the backstory here. Why are rates going up? What do we need to know?
Well, our rates are going up July 1st this year. It's our fiscal year at the city. They're going up about 16.3%.
Mm-hmm. So that's significant.
It might be our largest rate increase, and that is a big function on it has to do with really how we process our waste and moving forward, it's how we're going to be processing it. So a large chunk of that 16.3 is due to costs for our materials to be received up at the landfill. And the landfill's slowly filling up, and
right.
One of the big ways to kind of avoid that is to better process our materials. And so there's a new facility called the Resource Center that's being built. It's currently under construction. It's slated for sometime in 2021, and that new facility is going to be sorting our materials a lot better, pulling out a lot of the recyclables that end up in our trash, pulling out organics, which could be food or mm-hmm. wet paper, and then processing those into compost and some renewable energy.
Right. I mean, we've covered this a little bit, how the processing facility just up the coast from us here is, frankly, the folks up there that run it are kind of running out of space.
Yeah.
And talk a little bit more about why that 16% increase, why that's necessary in terms of the details of that plant. Is it to fund kind of some of the new facilities that are going online there? I mean, what should people know about that?
Yeah. So to fund the facility itself, our cost per ton for the county landfill to receive our material is going from $102 per ton up to $150 per ton. So it's a big jump there. And that is mainly to fund the construction of this facility. Year over year, moving forwards, it won't be that large of a jump anymore.
I see.
It's going to be $5 increase, I think, per year to that per ton fee.
Got it.
So we won't have this kind of jump next year. It will always be increasing. But
sure. Yeah. Well, okay. So this goes into effect July 1st. So we have a little bit of time to prepare for it. But there's also other components of this that are interesting that we're going to need to kind of be a little bit more specific and rigorous in the way that we recycle and sort our trash and recycling materials. Say more about that.
Yeah, so I mean right now a large chunk of our what we receive as recyclables is actually trash. Mm. We call it residual content. So it's about 25% or maybe around a quarter of our materials actually that is getting collected in a blue bin is then getting sorted out as trash and is being landfilled. And so there's an extra cost to that as well.
This is really interesting to me because I think we have this kind of vague sense of what is supposed to be recycled.
Right.
But I don't think we actually do know what's supposed to be recycled. Like greasy pizza boxes cannot be recycled even though they are cardboard. I actually did not know that.
Right.
Your public radio host did not know that.
Yeah.
I mean, so expand upon that. I mean, it's more specific than we think.
Yeah. And so a lot of our the rules that are changing right now have been in place, but I would say they haven't been as heavily enforced because a lot of the materials we were able to sort and find markets. So even some contaminated materials like plastics that had food or water on them. But now it's much harder to find markets. So, I mean, it's a commodity. You collect it and it's being sold to someone else who's turning that material into something else. And, you know, we've never allowed food or water in our recycling bin, but, you know, to a degree, we didn't want people to waste a ton of water cleaning materials and wiping them out because we were in a drought as well. So, you know, we kind of had this discussion where, you know, when in doubt, throw it in the recycling bin.
Okay.
And we are shifting away from that to if you're really in doubt whether or not it's recyclable, it's probably better to put it in the trash.
Interesting. So I'm just curious, what's like the biggest offender when you look in those recycling bins? Is it things that still have food waste on it or what is it, do you think?
The biggest stuff is really film plastics. Huh. So that's plastic wrap, Ziplocs, plastic bags, packaging wrap, any of that really flimsy, thin plastic material, that is a big contamination issue. Bags in general, everything in the blue bin should be empty and loose. We don't want to have any bags in there. And then food and water contamination. Yeah, there's always going to be some residual water in beverage bottles or liquid, but, you know, try and rinse it out as best as you can and cap it off so that that water doesn't get out. And the reason for that is that if our paper gets wet, it's not recyclable.
Interesting. To think again about some of these recycling changes, I mean, we're going to have to start sorting differently at home. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, for the most part, we're not going to be impacted by some of the changes.
Okay.
A lot of our recyclables by weight are mixed paper, cardboard, glass, metal. The plastics make up a very small percentage, and some of the plastics that we're going to not accept moving forwards are going to be these food plastics. So pretty much plastics that ever had some sort of food in it. And the reason for that being is those types of plastics are generally some that aren't marketable anymore. Mm-hmm. And then on top of it, it's a huge contamination issue. If you put a yogurt cup in there, if it's totally clean and dry in the past, we would have accepted it. But now the likelihood that those containers that had food in them are going to be clean and dry is very small.
And we've spoken about this on the show before, but it's worth reiterating and just reminding folks that a big reason that this is happening is because China used to be the primary market for recycling plastics, and they're no longer doing that.
Yeah, and it's a big wake-up call to us and, you know, to our residents to realize that, you know, China before was accepting about 50% of the world's plastic. And what that means is benefiting by getting this plastic trash essentially from a lot of other countries and turning it into other materials, but at the cost for their environment. They don't have as high environmental standards as we do, especially here in California. So they were externalizing those costs up front, and they've decided they don't want to, you know, process our materials over there anymore. So all of a sudden we have a glut of plastic waste. And some of those are still great. You know, our beverage bottles, anything that had a liquid in it, any of those plastics are totally fine. There's still a market for them.
Mm-hmm.
Anything with a bottle deposit, you know, the 5 cents that you pay at the supermarket, that's fine. But they decided, you know, and it wasn't technically a ban. They just decreased the threshold for contamination so small that our processing can't get there.
Okay.
As
these changes go into effect, I'm just kind of curious to get your larger perspective on what all this means. And for those of us that forever had never really thought about this, you know, we just threw stuff out, threw it in bins. I mean, do you feel like we're at a moment right now, considering our local, you know, dump and processing facility is running out of space, that we kind of need to wake up a little bit and think about this more and not just kind of pretend it doesn't exist.
Yeah. And, you know, to look at the brighter side of things too, it does, it does make us reevaluate, some of the materials that we throw out. And I like to think about any material going into any bin, as a waste material. If you're throwing it in the blue bin, even if it is recyclable, if you could have avoided it in some way, it's still waste. There's still extra resources that are getting used in the collection and the processing and the repurposing of that material into something else. And if it could have been avoided, then all those resources that are needed to do recycling could have been avoided as well.
Brian Latchford is an outreach coordinator at the Environmental Services Division at the City of Santa Barbara. Brian, thanks again for the time.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Now let's head up the Central Coast to San Luis Obispo County and talk about emergency preparedness and what county staff are doing to plan for future possible man-made and natural disasters. KCBX's Greta Mart has more.
I'm here in the KCBX studio with, I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself. I'll start with you on my left here.
My name is Jillian Ferguson, and I'm with the County of San Luis Obispo's Department of Planning and Building.
Okay, great. How about you?
I'm Scott Milner with the County Office of Emergency Services.
And we're here to talk about an emergency plan that you guys have come up with for the county, correct?
A local hazard mitigation plan.
Local hazard mitigation plan, so LHMP. Tell me, how did this process start, and where are you guys now?
Well, the county had a hazard mitigation plan, but it was due to be updated because you have to update them every 5 years. So we had one existing, and it's time to review and update it. And this time we wanted to make it a multi-jurisdictional plan instead of just covering the county itself. So we included the cities and a lot of the special districts.
And how are you involved in it?
So the planning department is interested in this plan because it will definitely enhance our safety element, which is a plan within our general plan. And so we look forward to enhancing and beefing up our safety element using the LHMP because they worked together so well in tandem. So having a robust local hazard mitigation plan and safety element is very important for FEMA funding, which Scott can speak to.
Okay.
And the federal government invests a lot of money every year in grant programs because they're looking to reduce losses due to natural disasters. So they invest in these grant programs. So if you have an approved hazard mitigation plan and there's projects outlined in your hazard mitigation plan, you can apply for grant funding, which will fund 75% of the projects. So that's their incentive to have a hazard mitigation plan.
So what are some scenarios, like an earthquake, or what are scenarios where this would be applied, and what does it mean? Like
earthquake, flooding, wildfire are some of the big ones.
We've held two public workshops so far, and we're going to have two more. And it was really interesting to see that the public has identified the natural hazards as most critical for the county as being drought and water shortage, wildfire, and emergency evacuation routes. So we look forward to hosting two more public workshops to gather more input. The next workshop is going to be focused on the mitigations that the county and also the other jurisdictions within the county have drafted to receive their input. And then we will be releasing the draft hazard mitigation plan in mid to late July. And we'll be looking forward to public input throughout July and mid-August.
Okay, and so let's get into the specifics of the plan. Let's talk about San Luis Obispo, the city itself, because, you know, obviously it's going to be different all over the county. But in the city, have you identified routes where you're going to have people leave? Is this the kind of plan that this entails?
For specific hazards, the county has for emergency response plans for like tsunami or wildfire. They're hazard specific. Some of those have evacuation routes identified. But as a broader whole, it's not usually predetermined every evacuation route. But that was one of the mitigation actions that will be in the new plan is to enhance evacuation planning based on recent events.
Give me some scenarios. What would happen if a tsunami was on its way?
Well, we have existing tsunami inundation maps, which would show how far in the water would come, and there's predetermined evacuation routes for those. In addition, we're working on putting up tsunami signage that would mark evacuation routes. And there's a certification you can get through the National Weather Service to become a tsunami-safe community. So we're working toward that goal of getting those signs up and becoming a tsunami-safe community.
And in order to receive that funding, having the HMP, the Hazard Mitigation Plan, and the safety element better puts us in a position to receive that funding for those mitigations.
Okay, got it. All right. If there was an emergency happening, how do we know what to do?
We have various ways of communicating with the public, which includes the emergency alert system and a wireless emergency alert system. So you either receive that through your cell phone or through TV or radio. So we have various means of sending out emergency information to the public as far as protective actions to take.
Okay, and you have everybody's cell phone number?
That's a system that's signed up with the cell phone companies. You'd have to opt out versus opt in. So you'll receive WIA regardless, unless you specifically try to opt out of it.
Got it. Okay. Because these days, I mean, say there was an emergency and power was cut off, so you wouldn't be able to see the TV. Radio, you might have, you know, my radio is plugged in. So, and I don't know how many people have transistor radios anymore, but so it sounds like the cell phone these days is kind of how you're going to get the information.
Cell phone and car radio. And we could also activate the county's emergency siren system, which is 131 sirens.
Wow. Okay. All right. I've heard the tests, of course.
The sirens just alert you to tune in to local radio, TV.
And also, if I might add, in this plan, we're excited to make sure that it's more inclusive. So we want to ensure that we're reaching out to environmental justice communities and vulnerable communities as well. So we are considering different approaches, ensuring that everybody will receive alerts and proper communication.
Okay, right. So if I don't have a cell phone, if I can't afford a cell phone,
right.
If I can't afford TV, then how would you get the message to me?
Yeah, so those are we're considering different strategies and approaches.
Can you talk about some of those?
Yeah, there's also weather alert radios you can purchase, and everybody has a radio in their car as well, which doesn't rely on shore power, so you could always tune into a radio station through your vehicle.
Right, mm-hmm.
And distributing resources in different languages, ensuring that we've identified different community centers that different communities go to or frequent. So ensuring that various approaches and resources are utilized.
Is there anything else that you want folks to know about this?
Yeah, we were just looking for next month when the draft hazard mitigation plan is released, that we're looking for public input on the draft plan because we want to get all the public's issues addressed that they're concerned with as far as natural hazards and maybe even the mitigation actions they'd like to see taken on either throughout the county or in the cities that are represented. So we just want to make sure we capture the public's opinions on those and make sure we capture all that in the plan.
That was KCBX's Greta Mart in conversation with San Luis Obispo County's Julianne Ferguson and Scott Milner. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Tyler Pratt here. Fracking has been a hot topic in Central California ever since the Trump administration released an environmental review about the possibility of expanding hydraulic fracturing on federal lands. That's about 1.6 million acres of lands in 8 counties. The release of the report has drawn criticism from political leaders like Governor Gavin Newsom and Central Coast U.S. Representative Salud Carbajal. Recently, the Bureau of Land Management, or the BLM, held 3 public meetings about the report. There was one in Slo County, one in Santa Barbara County, and another with our neighbors to the east in Kern County. For more insight on how the meeting went in the San Joaquin Valley, Valley Public Radio's Laura Tsutsui sat down with KVPR reporter Carrie Klein to shed light on what the BLM document says and does, and shares how residents have responded.
Hey, Carrie.
Hi, Laura.
The administration put out this environmental review. What's in this document?
So the document has a super wonky name. It's called a Draft Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement. It's put out by the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM. And all that really means is it's a supplement to a 2014 plan. And it came out because there was a lawsuit against that plan. And the way this kind of addresses it is it kind of did a deeper dive into this environmental review. And it says if we open up 1 million acres of federal land in Central California, California, if we open it up to hydraulic fracturing, there will be no significant environmental impacts. So after the meeting, I caught up with Gabe Garcia, who's the field manager for the BLM field office in Bakersfield.
This is a step in the process. You know, it's a 30,000 foot look on it. You know, are there impacts that we can't mitigate for? We haven't seen those yet, but you know, obviously we're as part of the comment period, we're looking for additional information to see if there are changes that need to be made.
What does this document actually do? Does that mean then that fracking could start happening next week?
No, this is not a regulatory document. It's just an environmental one. And just like any bureaucratic process, there are a whole bunch of steps that would need to happen before fracking could actually start. So the first is that this is only a draft. So Garcia says the BLM will take public comments into account before releasing the final draft, likely in the fall. And then, of course, there's the whole permitting process. There are two steps, apparently, that would involve public comment periods before an oil company could actually acquire land and begin working there. And then they also have to go through any county and statewide regulations. And all of that takes a lot of time.
Tell us more about where this fracking could take place. I mean, what land are we talking about here?
So we're talking about federal land in Central California owned by the BLM, or land that could be owned by someone else, but where BLM has jurisdiction over the subsurface mineral rights. And this is over about 1 million acres in 8 counties. It does not include lands in national parks, national forests, or national monuments, though I should note that there is already some oil and gas development happening in some national monuments. It was grandfathered in. And one thing I don't think that many people know is that there is already a lot of fracking happening in this area, particularly in Kern County. A little over 1,000 wells have been hydraulically fractured in California, either once or multiple times, and another 150 more have been permitted, but work hasn't actually begun yet. So none of that is included in this environmental analysis that only talks about this BLM federal land moving forward.
Well, at this public meeting last Tuesday, I understand maybe 150 people showed up. So clearly, I mean, they don't feel assured by this document. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. People are really concerned about a lot of things. The big picture about climate change, but also really the health of their communities. And so these people came from all over the Central Valley, you know, from at least as far north as Merced is who I saw, and then all over Kern County, things like that. You know, and they really want to protect water. They want to protect, you know, air quality in the environment. And so here's someone I spoke with named Saul Ruiz Martinez. He's a resident of Lost Hills. It's a small community adjacent to a ton of Kern County oil fields, lots of oil wells. He's the president of the Lost Hills Action Committee. He's speaking in Spanish, and I'll come in and explain what he says afterwards.
Me molesta que contaminan mucho el aire y el aire nos hace daño a todos. No importa raza ni color de piel ni nada. El chiste es que el aire está muy contaminado.
He's saying what really concerns him is air pollution, because it's something that harms everyone. It doesn't matter your race or the color of your skin, and that the air is already really contaminated and he doesn't want it to get worse. And so there is, you know, there is a point there. If you look at state data on air pollution, on air emissions, the oil and gas industry produces about 20% of the particulate matter, you know, produced by all stationary sources in the state. That doesn't include mobile sources like any trains or trucks that transport the material. But of course, you know, figuring out how much of that is because of fracking that's already occurring, that's really difficult to know. That's just the oil and gas industry in general. It's also been really difficult to pin down whether fracking chemicals have contaminated water sources. That's also a really big concern. That's partly because fracking chemicals are typically proprietary. However, there was a recent state water board report that did report that some chemicals from well stimulation techniques have mingled with groundwater sources in California. Although that report is short on details about where, which chemicals, and whether they're from fracking or other well stimulation techniques.
And not everyone's opposed to this document, right?
Absolutely. There were people who showed up at this meeting who think that, you know, this document really is dependable and that it shows that oil and gas production can be done responsibly. And after all, oil and gas, you know, that whole petroleum industry is a huge part of the economy and it provides lots of jobs in an otherwise not that economically stable a county. And so, you know, there are a lot of regulations that oversee the oil and gas industry and, you know, workers really feel that it's doing what it can to mitigate lingering impacts. So one of the people who also spoke there at this meeting was Lorelei Oviatt, and I caught up with her after the meeting. She's the director of planning and natural resources for Kern County. She says protecting the environment is a huge priority, and that's why her county enforces a lot of environmental requirements on every well they permit.
It is comprehensive. It includes air mitigation that they've never had to pay before. We're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars on each well just for the air mitigation. Why did they, and you would ask, why would an oil industry do that? Because in California, they do have their backs up against a wall. So they want to be well regulated because they can't move the oil.
She also points out that while Kern County is the biggest oil and gas producer in the state, it's also the state's biggest producer of electricity from both solar and wind. According to state data, it produces about a fifth of the state's electricity from solar power and just over half of the state's electricity from wind. Although it's also important to note that those sources, even though they're renewable, they are not without their environmental impacts as well.
Going back to the document, you mentioned that its contents were not the only issue on people's minds at the meeting. What else did attendees tell you?
Yeah, this was also a really big point mentioned by lots of people. And it's that, you know, people really felt like they were not being heard by the BLM. You know, one thing is that this meeting was not on the public record, which meant that nothing was being recorded. You know, the government went to the trouble of putting on these meetings, but they were not recorded as part of any official process. You know, officials like Gabe Garcia and others for the BLM had said that they'd provide a computer for submitting comments online, but they didn't, the day of, because there was apparently a lack of internet service in county buildings. Also, there was no Spanish interpreter. The only interpretation service was for American Sign Language. And Garcia had told me it's basically a slippery slope to start offering interpretation for some languages, but not others. There were a lot of Spanish speakers at this event, however, and, you know, so they were very unhappy about that lack of interpretation. And so, I also got to speak with Naimin Martinez. She's the director of the Central California Environmental Justice Network, and she was one of a few organizations who organized a busload of people, literally, to come attend this meeting. And here's what she thought about all of this.
We're, like, very upset with all this situation because, you know, it just continue like doing the things that they want the way they want, and you know that's why not only us but many organizations like the Center for Biological Diversity that have lawyers are already like you know getting ready to file a lawsuit if that's what is needed.
But these organizations all came up with a plan, at least to solve the problem of the meeting not being on the public record. They hired a court reporter to transcribe the meeting, which will then allow them to enter each comment in writing.
Some people were thinking it was pointless and a waste of time. So for us, you know, one way in, you know, kind of flipping the coin was like, okay, you're not going to do it, we're going to do it.
And so Gabe Garcia, when I asked him why this meeting would not be on the public record, he said that apparently the BLM has gotten in trouble in the past when they have transcribed meetings, that apparently there have been complaints that comments have been mischaracterized. So he says that generally in California, BLM meetings are not on the record. And so they're just basically meetings, not hearings. And I wanted to know Gabe Garcia's response to this sentiment that so many residents were sharing, that they just felt like they weren't being heard.
Whether or not you agree with them. I mean, do you at least understand kind of their complaints? And it wasn't just to me. I mean, you know, a lot of people voiced these concerns when they stood up as well in the meeting.
So, yeah, I think, you know, there's people, they're used to different setups. They're used to some of the counties and others that have a different protocol. And so, you know, I can see where they're coming from that perspective. But I think, you know, from our perspective, I think we want to make sure that we're capturing, you know, their comments in their entirety and really capturing what they mean. And so, you know, that's why we're stressing that you put your comments in writing for us so that we have those for the record.
And so it sounds like he's saying that they want comments submitted electronically, you know, in writing, but then it almost doesn't matter if people show up to voice their concerns in this public meeting.
I mean, Garcia would disagree with that. He says, of course, it matters anytime that the government has an opportunity to interact with the public, that's a good thing. But of course, lots of people feel that that's not enough, especially given that so many folks don't have easy internet access and that there are many, you know, there's a language barrier in a lot of places here in this valley to submitting comments in English.
That was KBPR's Laura Tsutsui speaking with reporter Carrie Klein about a recent new report and several public meetings about the possibility of expanding fracking in Central California. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. Well, KVPR's Carrie Klein recently jumped on the phone with Standard geophysicist Mark Zoback to unpack fracking basics, including what is and isn't known about the technique's impact on the environment.
So let's jump right in. So hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, is a well stimulation technique to help extract oil and gas from the ground. Why is fracking necessary and how does it work?
Well, fracking's been around for about 70 years or so, and it's used to produce more oil or gas from formations that have low permeability, in which it's hard for the natural gas and the oil to flow naturally. So you pressurize a section of a well and you induce a sort of a planar hydraulic fracture that propagates away from the well. You inject sand, typically, and then when you stop the pumping and the fracture tries to close, the sand kind of wedges it open, and therefore it makes it easier, a larger area for the oil and gas to flow into on its way to the well.
Okay, so now I want to unpack what's known and not known about the impacts of fracking. So let's start with induced seismicity, which a listener named Karen wrote to me. She's particularly concerned about. You know, there's been a tremendous uptick in seismic activity in Oklahoma near the oil fields where fracking is happening. What is the connection between fracking and earthquakes?
Well, there is a connection, and I'll get to that in a minute. I might point out that 95% of the earthquakes that occurred in Oklahoma were not related to hydraulic fracturing. They were related to the injection of produced water, that is, water that gets produced out of the reservoir along with the oil, and then the reinjection of that water at greater depth. That process is what caused most of the earthquakes, the great majority of earthquakes in Oklahoma. However, it is true that today hydraulic fracturing activities are responsible for earthquakes in Oklahoma. They're occurring also in West Texas, a place called the Delaware Basin, southwestern Texas. There have been reported instances in Ohio, a number of instances in Canada. So there are places where hydraulic fracturing has caused earthquakes, which are large enough in some cases to be felt. In no case have any of the earthquakes caused injury or caused damage, and none of the earthquakes in North America have ever been big enough to have caused problems. But they are noteworthy, and we want them not to occur. And so on average in Oklahoma, Texas, Canada, 2-4% of the wells that are hydraulically fractured have earthquakes that potentially could be felt. A much smaller number have earthquakes that actually have been felt.
Interesting. So the majority of these earthquakes, associated with oil and gas activity, they're more associated with wastewater reinjection, but there have been a few that have been associated with fracking as well.
That's especially true in the case of Oklahoma, and it's generally true throughout the central and eastern United States. But there are now, a number of well-documented instances in which hydraulic fracturing itself has triggered seismicity.
And so most of these earthquakes so far that have been documented, they're either too small to be felt or just barely felt. As you said, there hasn't been any documented destruction from them. But of course, California is highly seismically active. I mean, induced seismicity, is this something we should be concerned about in this state?
Well, seismicity is something we should be concerned about in the state, earthquakes in general. They're much more prone in some areas than others, of course. Most of the Central Valley, of course, is relatively aseismic, but there have been earthquakes in the areas where oil is being produced on the west side, mostly due to natural geologic processes. The way to kind of connect these issues, we do live in earthquake country. Hydraulic fracturing has the potential to trigger earthquakes. Is to be proactive. Earthquakes occur on faults, and what we need to do is assure ourselves that there are no faults that are going to be intersected by the wells that will be drilled, and also that there's sufficient monitoring. That what is used right now in Oklahoma, Alberta, Ohio, many places where earthquakes have been triggered by fracking, are stoplight systems. In other words, you deploy a special purpose seismic network immediately in the vicinity of the wells that are being hydraulically fractured. And if you start to detect activity, the green light turns yellow or the green light turns red. So you basically stop the process before perhaps a potentially damaging earthquake occurs. And these work pretty well. But the two steps are, first, you need to try to avoid the faults, which can be done by mapping the faults very carefully with seismic techniques, using what's called reflection seismology, which is kind of like a sonogram of the subsurface, maps out the formations. You look for the faults, and if they're there, you avoid them. And then you deploy these fit-to-purpose seismic networks, which are there to detect even the smallest event that might be associated with the hydraulic fracturing process.
Very interesting. Okay, well, we don't have that much time left, but I want to touch upon other environmental impacts. A lot of residents here, especially in the San Joaquin Valley, have really expressed concern about local impacts in their communities to either groundwater or air quality. What can you tell me about what's been documented in terms of, the risks and how those risks are perhaps being mitigated, where fracking activity is taking place?
Well, When fracking activities are going on, or when drilling is going on, it's like a large construction project, and with many, many vehicles, many big, many small, and so there are traffic issues, there are air quality issues, and a number of states have taken action. Colorado sort of led the way with air quality issues for the equipment that's actually operating at the site to try to minimize that, and so those are real issues, but they can be addressed through appropriate regulations and enforcement. That you just want to sort of minimize those impacts. There's nothing unique about hydraulic fracturing in the case of air pollution, traffic, noise. Just think of it as a large scale industrial process. And everyone recognizes that they're necessary, but they don't want it to be happening next door. And if it is, you want to be certain that the proper, the steps are taken to sort of mitigate its impact on local residents. With respect to water issues, the real issue is not hydraulic fracturing. The real issue is drilling the well and making sure the well is drilled properly, steel casing is put in properly, that casing is cemented properly. And when well construction is done right, the possibility of contamination is very, very low. In fact, both President Obama and EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson, toward the end of the Obama administration, pointed out that after millions, literally millions of hydraulic fracturing operations in the central and eastern U.S., not a single case had been documented in which the fracking process was the source of contamination. Now, there is contamination, and the cases in which there is contamination, it was always caused by poor well construction, whether you hydraulically fractured the well or not. So, yes, there are possibilities for contamination. There are possibilities for accidents. Things get spilled at the surface and so on. However, all the attention is paid on fracking, but it's actually the well construction part of it that's the source of the problems and the place to put our attention and make sure things are done properly to prevent the problems.
So, taking all these risks into account and taking what has been documented so far, can fracking be done responsibly?
Well, I think fracking has been done responsibly. I think it's hard for the public to recognize that hundreds of thousands of wells have been drilled in just the last, a little bit more than a decade, almost a decade and a half, since about 2005, when this, dramatic increase in activity has occurred. Hundreds of thousands have been wells have been drilled, and the wells, have had, in early days there were a few hydraulic fractures per well. Now there can be 40 or 50 hydraulic fractures per well. So literally millions and millions of wells have been drilled without serious incident. So that doesn't mean, it's not without potential problems, but you have to recognize what the problems are. You have to have appropriate regulations. You have to enforce those regulations, and you have to assure that that best practice is being followed. And when that is the case, problems are avoided. And So there's nothing, you know, new about any of all this, and sort of fracking has almost kind of gotten, you know, undue attention. The oil and gas industry has been around for a long time, and sort of the no fracking, you know, mantra focuses, you know, everyone's criticism on that activity when, in fact, you know, they're upset about the oil and gas industry in general, and in cases not without good reason. But one should recognize that, you know, we're just talking about an industrial process here. Food processing is an industrial process. Transportation, air flying, you know, flying in airplanes. You know, all of these things are complex processes, but they can be done safely, but they have to be done right. And hydraulic fracturing, drilling and hydraulic fracturing are no different than that. They have to be done right if they're going to be done safely. We know how to do it right, and we just have to be conscientious about that.
Okay, I've been speaking with Mark Zoback, a geophysicist at Stanford University. Mark, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Sure.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Here's the question many Democrats are grappling with as California's newly relevant and competitive presidential primary approaches. Do you pick the candidate who best reflects your policy views or the one you think has the best shot of beating President Trump? You're about to hear what four undecided California Democrats think. They recently sat down with Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler.
My name is Keen Chacuaneta. I work with a local labor union that unionizes healthcare workers.
And you're 27 years old, and you're from Richmond.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Joe Griego. I am the chief technology officer for the Mono County Office of Education, but I live in Bishop, California, in Inyo County, California. And I am our county, one of our county delegates.
Well, and you're 54 years old?
I'm 54 years old.
All right, and next?
My name is Rosemary Wren, and I'm an educator and a student in San Luis Obispo County, California, and I'm also the chair of our county Democratic Party. I'm 55 years old.
And you wanted to be clear that you were speaking for yourself and not for the party.
Exactly. Thank you.
All right. And?
I'm Mimi Falcone. I'm from Irvine, California. I'm 56 years old and a small business owner.
All right. Why don't we start by just going around and asking for your opening impressions of the weekend. You've had a chance to hear from 14 Democratic presidential candidates. That's about two-thirds of the 23 candidates who have declared so far. And so what stood out to you the most? What's each of your takeaways from this weekend? And let's start with Keen.
Okay. I have to say that some of the candidates who maybe I wasn't so hot on earlier impressed me with their rhetoric and the way that they were able to kind of get across I guess certain policies, ideas, values even.
Like who?
For instance, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, he's somebody who I've been extremely skeptical of, and I think that he did a really good job.
And why were you skeptical about him?
I honestly think that his policy or his rhetoric doesn't actually have a lot of kind of substantive kind of policy undergirding it. And I guess one thing that's really important for me is not only, you know, we always say who can win, who's electable, but for me it's how can you solve the problems that got us here? And that's why I still remain relatively skeptical of them.
And Joe, what stood out to you from this weekend?
I think changing hearts and minds requires engaging people's emotions. Donald Trump does an excellent job at that. I wish he didn't, but he does, right? It resonates with people, the things that he says. And that's what I was hoping to gain. So I wanted to hear people speak so that I could hear whether or not they had an emotional hook, and whether or not I could relate that to our constituency back in Inyo County.
And?
I did. I was excited to hear some folks speak. Some folks were a lot more dry than I had hoped. I liked, for example, what Elizabeth Warren had to say. She does, in fact, have a plan for everything. And she really strikes me as a policy wonk, which speaks to me. But she does. She is not as powerful an orator, which is a requirement, it seems like. When I heard, for example, Tulsi Gabbard, I didn't know that much about her, but she is can be a passionate speaker. But policy-wise, I need to make sure that I can go back and report to my constituents in Inyo County, well, here's what she says, here how exciting she can be, here are her policies. So we'll see. I'm excited to see what might happen in November.
Rosemary?
Yeah, I'm with Keen on this, where I heard from people who I was pretty skeptical about and felt a lot more energized by them than before. So Mayor Pete and Beto are actually two that got my attention more than they had before. I'm with you, though, on Elizabeth Warren and her policies and her plans. I think of all the speakers, she had the most to support what she wants to do. And it was a really great opportunity, I think, for Californians to hear from these candidates, because we are an important state in the upcoming election, and I think it was very important for us to get to hear from them.
And Mimi, your takeaways from the weekend.
Well, I was really anxious to hear from some of the candidates that I had read and heard from, but shockingly, by the end of the weekend, the ones that I was most eager to listen to were not the most memorable in my mind. And
what do you mean by that?
I was really excited to hear Mayor Pete, and in my opinion, did not deliver. And also Beto, I was very excited to hear from, and just kind of meh about. Elizabeth Warren, I was so pleasantly surprised by how engaging she was, as well as Cory Booker, really surprised me. And then I was at the Veterans Caucus last night and heard from Tulsi, and she was, and really didn't know much about her coming into this, and was very impressed.
So we actually have at the table here, we have two of you voted for Bernie Sanders in the 2016 presidential primary, Keen and Rosemary, and Joe and Mimi, you both voted for Hillary Clinton in the primary, and then all four of you voted for Clinton in the general election. It gives everyone an idea of, we have kind of a different set of views around the table. What are you most looking for in who you are going to vote for in March? There's this debate over policy views versus electability, or trying to have the best combination of the two. Where do each of you fall on that? And this time, let's start with Joe.
I think what's most important to me is, if I am honest with myself, electability. I wish I could say it was policy, but the Democratic Party planks are something that align with my values. And so, honestly, I'm not so worried about who specifically, as long as they are support the Democratic Party planks, and all of the members do. So for me, I'm looking for electability.
Does that mean that you will vote for the candidate in March who you think has the best shot of winning?
In all likelihood, yes.
Rosemary?
What I'm looking for is a candidate with integrity, who is also someone who I believe can lead. That being said, whoever does come out of the convention in 2020, I will support that candidate as a Democrat, because like Joe said, if they've adopted the Democratic Party principles and values, then I'm good with that.
Mimi?
I'm all about electability. I feel we have to get Trump out of office, and I will vote for whoever will get him out of office.
And Keen?
The way that I look at it is, we are where we are, and we have the president that we have, because I think that a lot of people were ignored to the point where they felt like this process wasn't working for them. And while I understand the concerns about, you know, electability, I also think that if we have that conversation now, we might be kind of closing the door on certain candidates. I mean, if you look at last cycle, the candidate who, at least on the Republican side, was polling the highest at this time was Jeb Bush, and we all know how that turned out. So, and I'm not saying that that's what you're saying now, right? But I think that there are a set of problems within, like, American society, both, like, in our politics and in our economy, that have led us to where we are. So things like income inequality that kind of reach out into every facet of our political life now are extremely important to me. And if you can show me that you have a plan to combat that on multiple fronts, you'll have my vote next year.
I'm going to throw some names out there of candidates. Three candidates who we haven't really spoken about yet at this table. Bernie Sanders, whom two of you voted for 4 years ago in the primary. It doesn't sound like any of you are necessarily sure that you're going to go with him again. I'm curious why. California's own U.S. Senator, Kamala Harris. No one's mentioned her so far, but here we are on her home turf. And, you know, she was very present throughout the weekend, but again, doesn't quite seem, even though you're all familiar with her and you've cheered her on at many conventions, doesn't necessarily seem like any of your first choices. And Vice President Biden, because he's leading in the polls. So just maybe a few words on your thoughts on each of them. And this round, I guess we will start with Mimi.
I really was excited about Kamala when I came to the convention. I heard her speak. I've heard her speak now over the weekend every day in different capacities. And while I think on a singular issue, she's excellent, when she spoke to the general session, I was not as impressed, which really surprised me. In my opinion, I don't think she has it to carry it nationally. Bernie, I heard speak briefly at the Veterans Caucus last night, and I feel a little bit that he's polarizing outside of our party. And I believe that the electability factor is we have to, as a party, get those NPPs on our side.
NPP, that of course is no party preference. It's California's version of registered as an independent voter.
And the moderate Republicans who are unhappy with Trump, we have to get them to vote Democrat. And we do that by finding commonality. And maybe Bernie has that commonality. I'm not so sure. And as far as Biden, he wasn't here this weekend. I have been able to hear him in person speak and think he's wonderful. But again, I don't know. You know, all of them have the name recognition that is required, the experience. However, they are all three people that raise the rankles of some. And while you're not going to make everyone happy, it's nice to get started without that baggage.
All right, Keen.
Yeah, I guess what I'll do is I'll start with the candidate that I feel most negatively about and work my way back from there. That's definitely Joe Biden. And I mean, the reason is this. I think, and well, first off, I'm the youngest person here, probably 27. And I feel like he discounts a lot of our pain and the issues that matter to us in ways that I think are extremely disrespectful, trying to say things like, oh, well, you know, millennials, you know, they complain about this, they complain about that. I'm lucky, but many of my friends are not. Many of them are crippled by student loan debt. Many of them will probably never be able to buy a home in their lives. Yeah, I find Biden to be pretty offensive in that way. Kamala Harris, her record as the district attorney here in San Francisco and how her office related to working people kind of freaks me out a little bit. And I'll kind of just leave it at that. And then as for Senator Sanders, I think a lot of the issues that we're talking about now as the Democratic Party in 2019 are issues that he put on the map in 2015 and 2016. And I think that says a lot, especially considering these are the same things he's been talking about basically for the last 40 years.
But you're not necessarily looking at him to vote, looking to vote for him?
No, because I also think Senator Warren might actually be doing a better job of fleshing out what some of these policy ideas look like. But that doesn't mean that Senator Sanders hasn't played an important role in tacking the conversation left in a way where Senator Warren even has the space to do what she's doing.
Joe, you didn't vote for Sanders 4 years ago, so I would imagine you probably won't vote for him this year. What are your thoughts on Biden and Harris?
Initially, I liked Joe Biden a lot. Obviously, if I admired the Obama presidency a great deal, and that carries a lot of cachet for Senator Biden, but I was dismayed by his recent remarks disavowing his 94 crime bill. It devastated communities of color, and he pretended like he didn't have anything to do with that. And I felt that that was disingenuous, so I'm not a big Joe Biden fan. I did have a chance to hear Kamala Harris speak, and she did not inspire the passion or the emotion that I had hoped for.
Why do you think that is?
That's a great question. I heard Cory Booker speak, and it was more inspiring. I think the key is you have to tie in to the mindset that voters want to see in their candidate our very best self, America's very best self. And I didn't hear that from Kamala Harris, unfortunately, which I was a little surprised about. I had really hoped for some more soaring rhetoric and a little more emotional connection.
All right, and so we'll end this round with Rosemary. You did vote for Bernie Sanders 4 years ago, so curious as to your thoughts about him as well as Senator Harris and Vice President Biden.
Sure. Well, I'll start with Vice President Biden, who I have a lot of admiration for. I was extremely disappointed that he chose not to be here this weekend.
Do you think he would have been booed if he had been here?
That's possible, but we saw two candidates up there who had the fortitude to come up and say what they want, that what they believed in, and they did get booed, but they were here. And I feel that in my mind it's kind of a metaphor for doing the same thing we've been doing all along, that he is assuming that he has the support and that he doesn't have to invest the time here. And I find that very unfortunate. I like Kamala Harris a lot. I was inspired by her. It's funny listening because we all heard different things from different people. I have a lot of respect for Kamala Harris. I find her to be a strong leader, and I can picture her leading this country. She's not my first choice of candidate, but I do think that she could be an extremely strong leader. I'm thinking less of what I heard this weekend and more about what I've seen her do in Washington, D.C. Bernie Sanders has been saying and doing the same thing for 40 years. Bernie went last night, because I know because I followed him, to every single caucus on this floor. And he was the first presidential candidate to ever go to the Arab American caucus. That was very meaningful. And I think it's also, again, it's a metaphor for the kind of person and the kind of candidate and the kind of leader that Bernie is that he is there for the people.
Could we end with two lightning round questions? The first, give me your first and second choices as of this moment in the primary. And then the second lightning round question is, will you vote for the Democratic nominee for president no matter what, whether it's anyone ranging from Bernie Sanders to Joe Biden? Keen, do you want to take a stab at those two lightning round questions first? They don't need to be long answers.
Yeah, sure. Tied for one, Sanders, Warren, and absolutely yes. I mean, anything is better than Donald Trump that we have forward right now.
Joe Griego.
Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker. I was inspired by Cory Booker. I think Elizabeth Warren could be an effective legislator and a wonderful leader.
And will you vote for anyone, for any Democrat for president?
Over any Republican, yes, every day of the week.
Rosemary Wren?
I'm with Keene, literally tied with Bernie and Elizabeth. I think either one of them would be ecstatic to see either one of them on the top of the ticket. And barring that, yes, I will vote for the Democratic nominee in 2020.
And Mimi Falcone.
Well, this is coming back full circle. I'm Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, and yes, I will vote Democrat no matter what.
And now, all of you together, can you name the 23 presidential candidates? Can you put your heads together and name all 23?
If you give us 15 minutes, we'll get there.
If I can Google it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, all of you, for making the time to talk. I'm just going to let everyone know who you are one last time. Keene Chukwuneta from Richmond, an organizer for a local healthcare union. Joe Griego from Inyo County, who works for the Mona County Office of Education. Rosemary Wren, who's a part-time lecturer and doctorate student from San Luis Obispo County. And Mimi Falcone, who's a small business owner from Irvine in Orange County. Thank you so much for talking with Capital Public Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Issues and Ideas will be on break next week. We'll return in 2 weeks. In the meantime, you can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.